this morning, a little late, folks. I'm sorry about that. We've had a busy morning. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 479. And Senator Nelson is here. We'll ask the staff to give us an update on this bill, and Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 479A in gross creates a tax credit for qualified advanced telecommunications facilities if they're certified by the Economic and Community Development Department. Criteria for certification include improved telecom access and technology availability in currently underserved areas, and some other criteria as well. Total certified cost in a year cannot exceed $10 million. The tax credit is equal to 20% of the certified cost of the facilities with no carry forward, and the effective date for the tax credit is January 1, 2002 and thereafter. The certifications may be issued by the Economic and Community Development Department between January 1, 2002 and December 31, 2005. The Economic and Community Development Commission is also required by the bill to report to the legislature on the progress of the program by March 15, 2005. And finally, the bill stipulates that the Public Utility Commission may not require a rate reduction as a result or in exchange for the tax credits under this bill.
Thank you very much. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pelton. This is Senate Bill 479 is a continuation of the bills that we started in the last session. As you probably all aware, we passed Senate Bill 622, which is a building and infrastructure. I've left a copy of a map up on your desk, which shows that the sonic rings that we have are just about in the process of the contracts being signed. This is the $70 million investment that Quest provided to the state of Oregon in exchange for some regulatory reform. We're now at the stage that I think the crucial issue is Senate Bill 622 just built the infrastructure out. It did not connect the last mile. I think Senate Bill 479 is a tool that would help complete the process of 622. It's not the entire answer, but it's something that, how do you create the incentive to go out and build this information technology infrastructure to benefit the people of the state of Oregon throughout the state. So there's folks in the audience that have a much greater knowledge of the details and the actual workings of this, but I'm here in support of it and would answer any questions that the committee would like to put forth. I can tell you that your co-chair, Senator Beyer, is at a meeting in the Southern Willamette Research Corridor, and they're very concerned with what's going on down there. There's a map here showing that they're actually connected to the world. What Senate Bill 622 does is help that process along, and Senate Bill 479 would be a tool to be able to use completing of that connection to the world.
Thank you. And Senator, would you like also to testify on 229 at this time?
Yes, if I could.
So,
please. Yeah.
We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 229.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 229 is brought to you. It's designed to create incentives to invite e-commerce enterprise zones, and Senator Edgar is here, and Ed Berkman, and I think that all these bills in some respects are related. You know, what we're trying to do is create these opportunities to expand upon what we did in 622 to create the necessary infrastructure, interconnectivity, the redundancy, the things of those nature that we need to move the state forward on an economic viable basis, because when you look at it, we're paying for our schools and our health care and our public safety with our income tax dollars, and we're only as good as our economy. And if we're not in the situation where we're entering into the 21st century knowing that we have an information economy, if we're going to succeed. It's going to be a global economy, and we have to have those tools available for our people in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. I want to ask the committee staff to tell us a bit more about the bill, and then we'll invite further testimony.
Chair, Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. Senate Bill 229 allows the sponsors of an existing enterprise zone to request designation for electronic commerce. It allows the Economic and Community Development Department to approve up to 5 of these zones. There are currently 44. For electronic commerce designation, striving to achieve a regional balance across the state in the zones that they approve. It makes firms engaged in electronic commerce eligible for property tax exemption on qualified new investment in enterprise zones approved for electronic commerce. Grants a non-refundable income tax credit equal to 25% of the new investment related to economic commerce, economic service, and order fulfillment or broadband infrastructure. If the taxpayer is a qualified business firm engaged in electronic commerce in an enterprise zone approved for electronic commerce, it allows a 5-year carry forward of the unused tax credit and limits the credit to tax years where at the beginning of the year the firm's qualified property is eligible for the property tax exemption. And it defines then electronic commerce zone. And this bill also takes effect on January 1, 2002.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan Deckert from Beaverton and Tigard. I think I'm going to let Mr. Craig Berkman go first. He has an appointment at 10 in Portland, and Craig was instrumental, A, in starting the Oregon Internet Commission, and B, in the idea that we put e-commerce enterprise zones together. This comes from the Oregon Internet Commission, and with that, I'll give you Mr. Craig Berkman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Craig Berkman from Portland, Oregon, member with Senator Deckard of the Oregon Internet Commission. Oregon historically has had a number of debates about the inability of the state to compete in certain taxing areas, and we have taken a sales tax initiative to the voters of the state on 9 occasions, and the voters have spoken overwhelmingly against having a sales tax. I think that this bill gives Oregonians an opportunity to make an advantage of the fact that we're a non-sales tax state for the economic benefit of people throughout Oregon. Specifically, what am I referring about? Referring to, rather. This bill should be looked at in the context of current federal law as well as state law that now exempts from taxation any commerce that's done on the Internet. There is a growing debate at the federal level whether that moratorium on no taxation should continue. And there are many folks, including a number of us here in Oregon, who believe that moratorium should continue to stay in place. If that is the case, Oregon, being one of a very few number of states without a sales tax, has a unique opportunity to become the e-commerce capital of the country. And if, in fact, we were able to achieve that objective, it has a number of positive economic development activities for communities throughout Oregon. Specifically, what would those economic development activities be? If you're engaged in e-commerce, and the best example that I can give you that's already operating here in Oregon is a company called 800.com in Portland that sells consumer electronics throughout the country. All of its assets are domiciled here in Oregon. And one of those assets is its fulfillment house. All of its products are shipped from Oregon across the country to people who buy from that site. Now, clearly, warehousing and fulfillment houses has an industrial real estate component to it, number one. Number two, some of the highest paying blue-collar jobs in America are associated with fulfillment warehousing activities. So there is a direct labor, blue-collar job creation component to what 800.com is doing. Number three, there clearly, because this is done over the Internet, there is a technology component to their business which allows and provides high-paying jobs in a technology area that are very competitive throughout the other job alternatives that Oregonians would look at. And last but not least, because of the previous investments the state has made historically to the benefit of all of us, we have a number of airports and other transportation facilities already in place throughout Oregon in which you could move these goods and services quickly to consumers throughout the country. So we're not talking necessarily about furthering the economic vitality of the valley. These companies could be located close to the Redmond Airport, to the Klamath Falls Airport, Pendleton down in on the coast, and you could have all of these components involved if we were able to move in that direction. Oregon, unlike the other non-sales tax states of the nation, has a much better infrastructure already in place, and thanks to the leadership and commitment of this legislature and previous legislatures, you have been courageous in setting aside assets to develop and make sure you have that last mile connection throughout every community in Oregon. And if we're really serious about making sure that every Oregonian has an opportunity for good jobs after they've completed their education and will have an opportunity and an option to stay in the community that they were raised in, it seems to me that this is a wise investment over the long term and would send a positive signal to those in the private capital markets to invest in companies that would choose to locate here or to grow here and to diversify their physical location in places other than the corridor. So that is why we very strongly on the commission recommended that you look at expanding a model that you already have in place to include electronic commerce, and the adverse impact on short-term revenue, I think, would be clearly far outweighed by the increased income taxes that would come to the state as we're creating these new jobs and creating these new investments that hopefully would be beneficial to everyone. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to briefly describe this to you this morning.
Questions from the committee? No questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Harkin.
Senator Deckard.
This is into the e-commerce committee in the Senate, correct? Maybe it's substantial amendments to the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, this went through our e-commerce committee, our information committee, passed out 5-0.
Right. I'm ready to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your time this morning. And Mr. Chair, the only thing that I would add, and I think a lot of lobbyists have said, once you have the votes, don't talk more. The only thing I would add is I think Mr. Berkman brings a valuable perspective as a venture capitalist that has seen many of these proposals on his desk. And that was the nature of the discussion that we had on the Internet Commission, is how do we ensure that all of Oregon benefits from the technology and the new economy, and that really not just our neck of the woods, Mr. Chair, which is Washington County. We want to ensure that rural and economically depressed areas of Oregon also get the benefit from this really incredible diversification that has happened in our economy. And I think this is a very ingenious idea that came about from our commission. And with that, I will be happy to answer any questions, and I'm so pleased to have the full attention of this committee as I testify this morning.
For your information, Senator Deckard, we're counting votes. You might be very interested in that.
I understand, and now I know what it's like to be on the other side as people talk the whole time.
See, you were okay until you made that last one. Senator, can I ask the other senator?
Yes, Senator George.
Thank you. Senator, really appreciate this bill. And another thing I appreciate, and I would like your counsel on here, we moved out, I believe that was Tuesday. I had to be on a radio program, so I was unable to be here. A bill that was kind of preemptive in the sense of saying, you know, we won't tax our e-commerce businesses out of business. Mm-hmm. And, we watered that down a big bunch before I went out of here. I wish that had been here. I don't know if it would have made a bit of difference. But what is your opinion on this idea? In other words, we're encouraging them here to come in. On the other side, we're not protecting them from possibly other additional taxes on their new startup enterprises.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator George. I, I tend to agree. I think Oregon is in a very unique position in terms of this because of the lack of a consumption tax that we have. And so I would have favored as strong as language as you possibly can, making ourselves, at least for a certain period of time, because right now other states are engaged and they're in a precarious position. Washington, very precarious because they have a high sales tax. And so they are going to lose, as more and more business goes online, they're just going to lose revenue. And I think this is the one area where Oregon actually can capitalize. And any bold statements we make in this respect or in respect to the bill that you passed out, mm-hmm. and I hope it wasn't watered down too much, because I really think that the federal legislation that is moving and that state bill does nothing but help Oregon. And that's what we heard from several of the folks in that industry, is that Oregon is seen, as long as we make the right steps, as a real place to come and do business. And hopefully this will also incentivize them, not just coming to Washington County and Portland, but also looking out to all over Oregon and what might happen in McMinnville and Newburgh and Cottage Grove and Troutdale and Gresham and way past Hill.
Let me go get my map.
Thank you.
South Hills of Eugene, they need some economic development.
I want to qualify for all present that this is public hearing only. We will not be voting on this bill this morning. But thank the good senator from Troutdale for looking for the votes anyway. Further questions?
There's some folks from OEDD, I believe, in the counties.
Senator Sheet, so over there.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Why don't we have revenue impacts on either one of these two bills?
Because of
the
public hearing.
And so you don't do the revenue impacts of the work session?
That's part of what's going on first.
I see. Okay.
We will continue the public hearing on 229. That's where we are at the moment. And I invite Patrick Allen and Steve McClure to come forward. And we have one other. Well, let's see. Yeah, this is Craig Berkman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve McClure, Union County Commissioner and President of the Association of Oregon Counties. And my comments on 229 will be very brief. I think from a local perspective, the thing that we find attractive about this is it gives us another opportunity to do economic development, but there's also a piece in there that allows local governments to be involved in whether you do it or not. And I think that's, from a local perspective, we always think that's important, that we are able to weigh in and be part of the process. I think we get a little bit uncomfortable when these things are mandated without us being able to assess them as they meet our community needs. So from a local perspective, we think this is a great tool. From my community, it's a tool that we certainly intend to use, take a look at. We are currently have an enterprise zone in our community, so it's something that we could build on. I certainly want to encourage support of this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corson.
So you don't view this as an unfunded mandate to your local government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, if we have the local option there where we can make a decision based on what's best for our community, no, we can deal with that. I think the problem that we sometimes get into is what's viewed as something that we have to do, and you take the local choice piece out of it. That's when local governments have the most problem with some of these things.
Mr. Chair, so, I mean, the summary of the bill says exempts property of business firm engaged in electronic commerce from property taxation if firm obtains certification. How is it that the local government weighs in on that, then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I don't have a copy of the bill, but there is language in there that a resolution has to come from the sponsoring local government for this to go forward. And
okay,
I think that's
you.
The key to us, is that we have the ability to have that discussion at that point.
Okay. Yeah, I see it here in Section 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I work for the Economic and Community Development Department as its Small Business and Emerging Technology Manager. Just very quickly, in terms of a couple of details about how this program would operate, Senator Corcoran raises the issue of the local option. This basically works as a system where we would create 5 zones in response to applications from jurisdictions with enterprise zones that that want to be able to offer this electronic commerce feature. I'd also point out that the bill requires us to, where possible, use a degree of geographic diversity in making those designations so that we get a variety of different economic circumstances in parts of the state that are able to participate in the program. Real quickly, I just want to give you an idea of some of the companies that we anticipate would make use of this kind of a program. When you think of electronic commerce, it's easy to think of the sales and customer service aspect, which is kind of what most people immediately think of. Craig Berkman talked quite eloquently about the fulfillment element of this in terms of warehousing and distribution. I think the third piece to bear in mind that would benefit from this bill as it's currently drafted is the actual provider of the last mile of pipe actually to the doorstep of the business. This would be the local internet service provider or other similar company that would actually have to do that very expensive provision of high capacity internet service to a business to be able to make use of the credit. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about how we would anticipate operating this.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So you envision that the beneficiaries of this would be, for instance, a communications company and not the particular, we had a guy in here the other day that called them dot bombs. It's not the dot bomb company then, it's
dot compost, I've heard too.
Dot compost, I like that, yeah. So is it the communications provider that you see getting this benefit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, all of the players in this would have some ability to have some kind of an incentive to make the capital investments up and down the line that are necessary. One of the pieces of testimony that we heard a number of times on the Internet Commission was that it's great to have these investments that are causing these redundant rings around the state to provide points of presence at a number of locations, but you still got to make an expensive investment to get from that point of presence to the doorstep of the actual facility that's going to be engaged in e-commerce or distribution, and that's a very expensive investment that the market is not driving to the kinds of communities that we would expect to designate these zones in. And so, yeah, the internet service providers or local company providing that last mile or last few hundred feet in many cases would be one of the entities that would benefit, but not the only entity.
And, Mr. Chair, what's the term that you use, the term of art for the distribution center?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I use the term fulfillment. That's my term, and it's a term that's out there. It's not a.
And that describes the place from which the once you've made the order through e-commerce, it's been shipped. Why, even if we give enterprise zone exceptions, why is somebody going to locate away from an international airport or away from a rail line or away from an interstate highway to ship stuff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, when you started with airport, I thought I had an answer, but when you expand it to rail and freeway, I think you're right. Distribution does require access to good transportation facilities, but we've already, through use of the existing Enterprise Zone program, had good experience with that distribution function being leveraged out to a variety of communities around the state, in the Boardman area, in the Roseburg area. With distribution that is somewhere other than Portland, where you might expect it to be. So we think this is an added tool to help leverage that yet further.
Okay. Question from Senator Chastia.
Thank you. And in looking at this bill, this does not create new enterprise zones or more enterprise zones. It simply uses the existing zones and then creates these new electronic commerce zones within those. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee?
I guess I have one more, Mr. Chair.
Question, Senator Corcoran.
You mentioned that it's a local option. And, Mr. McClure, is it a local option for special districts as well?
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, it's the sponsor, and I'm not sure that special districts can be the sponsor. I think cities and counties are the sponsors of the current districts, so I'm assuming that would be the where it would come from with you.
So, Mr. Chair, a special district could look at this as an unfunded mandate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, possibly, yes. Yeah.
I just want to get that on the record because We get hammered all the time for unfunded mandates.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cochran, and I think that's important that if you do have it at a local level, then the special districts can come to our process and say, hey, we have a problem with what you're doing here. That allows, I think, that input to have those discussions about what those impacts are going to be, whether there's a trade-off between the economic upturn and what that does to those local districts. But that still allows that local discussion to occur so that we do have it in the community where I think it belongs.
I'm thinking of an area like Yonkala that's, you know, developing a site and would have a, you know, possibility of getting something like this in. You put in a large distribution center, you're probably going to create a huge impact on the fire district down there, but they're not going to have had a voice in the development of this if Douglas County, the city of Yonkala, is the sponsor. I mean, they'd have a voice, but they wouldn't have the voice.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cork, and I guess I might add that the existing Enterprise Zone program that this is layered onto does require that consultation between the sponsoring jurisdictions and other taxing jurisdictions that would be impacted. Now, at the end of the day, it is either the city or county, the sponsoring jurisdiction, that get to decide whether to move forward. But we do require that there be interaction with other taxing jurisdictions.
You require that all taxing jurisdictions be on board?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman. Senator George. Relative to that question, though, when you have anyone who would come in bringing new enterprise, you're going to have all the support, the staff that's going to be there, all the other businesses are going to be there to support that new entity, and each one of those under Measure 50, in fact, are going to then begin to yield immediately return into the local jurisdiction. Isn't that correct?
If they get a tax credit.
Well, no, I mean, they're outside of this now. They're not part of that. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the employees. We're talking about any industry that may be present in the community, not in the enterprise zone, not relative to the exemption. Any expansion that they would be taxable.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, you're right. I think, and that's the trade-off. That's the discussion that you have to have in the community is does that secondary value with the increased benefit of more homes, newer homes, the economic activity in your community,
right,
versus the direct value of the foregone property taxes. And I really believe that discussion needs to occur in the local community. And when it is, you usually come out on the side of economic development, especially in the part of the world that I'm from. You know, it's not a hard sell out there. You know?
Okay.
When our income levels are much lower than the rest of the state and so on and so forth, this is the kind of thing that we're looking at. But I think from local government's perspective is we still think that we need to have those discussions in the community, whether it is a local choice, a local decision.
Thank you. Thanks, Senator George. Any further questions? Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. I'd like to call forward Craig Bertram.
Craig has already testified.
He's already testified, thank you. Actually, what we'll do is ask if there's any other person here present but wishes to testify on Senate Bill 229A. Senator Deckard, have you already made your input? And you're here for Senate Bill 479, I believe, also. 229. Okay. And because we have scheduled only the public hearing on this bill today, we will not move the bill today, but we have it on the public record. It is a timely hearing, so it stays on the table for our future consideration. So we will be revisiting this issue. We're in public hearing also on Senate Bill 479A. I'd like to call Mr. Edvilson and Commissioner McClure. Good morning, gentlemen. I welcome you today and ask for your testimony on Senate Bill 479.
Chairman Perry, all these senators. My name is Terry Edvilson. I'm with the Eastern Oregon Telecommunications Consortium, which is a 11-county consortium of communities, internet service providers, telecommunications companies, and local governments interested in expanding telecommunications services to unserved and underserved areas across the state, urban and rural. We ask you to consider Senate Bill 749 as an economic development and quality of life investment. You heard about Senate Bill 229 recently, and we think this simply complements it. It's the next step, as Senator Nelson said earlier this morning, in the investment in rural infrastructure. and infrastructure that would serve areas like Northeast Portland that are currently underserved with telecommunications, access to advanced telecommunications services. Also, please realize the concept has been and is being tested. I handed out some spreadsheets from the state of Montana, which indicates where investments have been made in the year 2000 and 2001 with their tax credits. They've been made in the rural small communities across Montana to bring advanced services into those communities for business and quality of life purposes. In talking with the Department of Commerce staff in Montana, they can't prove, but they strongly believe that it is advanced telecommunications investments in the state and is making a difference in making certain that the digital divide between the unserved and underserved areas isn't allowed to widen. We realize we're asking to make a spending decision with little empirical data to support that the investments will ultimately result in tax credits being repaid through increased income and corporate taxes, savings on social programs, and the ability to deliver improved educational services and health care. What we do know is Senate Bill 479, building on Senate Bill 622, will advance the deployment of critical information and telecommunications technology, elements increasingly critical to Oregon's economic vitality, as you've heard already this morning. Access to information technology and telecommunications has profoundly affected business location decisions. A few hardworking rural communities have taken a strategic approach and have been successful in luring companies with the right mix of broadband-based, advanced redundant telecommunications infrastructure and services, labor costs, and community investments. Commissioner McClure will probably talk to you about what's happened in Union County. This was accomplished in concert with telecommunications service providers. And in every case, with the support of the State of Oregon Economic Development Department playing a positive role by providing some incentive to help close the deal, to make the business case, which we continue to hear is critical. The infrastructure and regulatory landscape has and continues to change. The Telecommunications Act of 1996, Senate Bill 622, and numerous technological developments have led to the emergence of new possibilities. But without some incentive, it is often not reasonable to expect investor-owned companies to invest in middle and last-mile facilities in marginal areas where they have little hope of recovering their investment without help. We have heard heard understanding and agreement in numerous studies generated by legislative efforts of the importance and benefits of having widespread access to information technologies, advanced telecommunications, and the Internet. Senate Bill 479 is one more step in ensuring Oregon is positioned to be a player in the new Internet-driven information economy. We urge your passage of Senate Bill 479 as an economic and community development investment that will have impact on the impact of ensuring Oregon's information society is inclusive. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Edwardson? Hearing seeing none. Sir, I imagine that added to your previous testimony, it would be sort of a me too.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes. Again, I'm Steve McClure, Union County Commissioner, President of AOC, and Chairman of the Board of EOTC. In Eastern Oregon, we tend to wear a lot of hats, not too many of us. But anyway, I certainly do want to support the bill. And just briefly, in our discussions as we rolled out the high-speed broadband, we've had discussions with the small telephone companies in Eastern Oregon, and they currently have an investment out there that's working for them. They're making a profit on them. And here we come from government saying, we need more infrastructure. And we felt rather than just go out and demand that they give us more infrastructure, we tried to help them solve some of the business case that they had. And that's what this bill does. It goes out and tries to find some way to help them make the investments that we in the communities are asking them to make out there. And I think that's a real key in the piece. It pushes it out from the big rings back out the last mile into the communities. And so that's, I think that's the big driver on this thing, is so that when we deal with telephone companies on this infrastructure issue, we do it together rather than we as communities demanding them to do something that doesn't make sense from a business standpoint. So I think that's a big driver in what you're seeing in this piece.
Questions from the committee? Hearing and seeing none, are there any other folks here present who wish to offer testimony on Senate Bill 479?
Thank you very much.
Hearing and seeing none, we will close the public hearing on 479 and on 229A. colleagues, as you know, we are under some pressure to hear our bills before Monday, if we were to keep them alive on the table. So we'll ask all of our folks to come to the podium, put their reasons for support or opposition to the bill on the record in a very timely manner, and then we'll move forward. I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 499. There's been a panel put together from the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We'd like to hear from that panel. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Pamela Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Here with me is Mr. Ralph Goodwin, CEO of the Grant Baker Federal Credit Union, and Hal Scoggins, our retained legislative counsel. I do have credit union representatives here to support the bill from Hillsborough and Newburgh and Eugene, but if you don't mind, we'll just represent all of their views, and we will be brief. You do have extensive background and information in our packet, and we will summarize that for you. Mr. Scoggins is going to go.
And might add, you have representatives from Grant and Baker County and the Statewide Association, and I would just urge you to have your members beat our committee members up in the hallways committee meeting. But please add to the public record.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, the Senators. My name is Hal Scoggins. I am an attorney with Farley, Wada, and Witt, P.C. We are the outside counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. I'm simply here to offer this morning some brief technical background on the bill, an analysis of what it does, and I'll certainly be happy to answer any questions you may have when I'm finished. Essentially, public law, current law authorizes public officials to place money with any bank or trust company up to the amount that's insured by the FDIC or a qualified excess deposit insurance company. Credit unions are not among the institutions that are currently permitted to receive deposits of public funds, and that's the purpose of this bill, is to change that. Under current law, if a depository institution doesn't need to do anything further in order to accept public funds up to the amount that's insured by deposit insurance, in order to receive public funds in amounts that exceed the deposit insurance, an institution has to set up an arrangement whereby it collateralizes those deposits, and the minimum collateral amount currently is 25% of the amount that exceeds the amount of deposits that are insured by deposit insurance. The state treasurer monitors the financial condition of the financial institutions that participate in receiving public funds, and the state treasurer is authorized by the current law to increase the amount of collateral that's required for any particular depository institution that is receiving public funds if the treasurer believes it's necessary in order to ensure the safety of those funds. Financial institutions report regularly to their regulators, and the regulators in turn report to the state treasurer. What this bill proposes to do is simply to add credit unions to the list of eligible depository institutions that can receive public funds. As I mentioned, right now, banks and trust companies are eligible and credit unions are not. The change is relatively simple. We simply add credit unions in the places where banks and trust companies are currently mentioned in ORS Chapter 295 and 294. And we also add credit unions in the list of institutions that are qualified to hold the securities that serve as collateral for public funds that are deposited in amounts that exceed the amount covered by federal deposit insurance. I think it's important to point out a couple of things that SB 499 does not do. It does not require any public official to deposit funds into a credit union. It simply gives them the choice to deposit funds into a credit union if they believe it is necessary or appropriate and in the best interest of the public entity that they are charged with serving. It also does not set up any special rules for deposits of public funds in credit unions. Credit unions that wish to accept public funds deposits will be subject to all the same rules that banks and trust companies currently are. Instead, this bill simply expands the options that are available to public officers that are charged with managing the public's money. The Credit Union Association of Oregon believes that public officials should have the choice to deposit public funds in credit unions, which, like banks, are federally insured, heavily regulated institutions and are a safe place to put money. SB 499 is all about choice. It simply provides an additional choice to public officials in managing public money, and we believe that's simply an appropriate thing to do. Thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator George.
Okay. I read you some of the background information we have here. Oregon and Federal Credit Union Act allows credit unions to accept public deposits. Our Oregon law prohibits public entities from depositing the funds. And so apparently in other areas, this is accepted practice.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, that is correct. There are a number of states, over 20 states, which currently permit their state institutions and funds managers to deposit money with credit unions. The federal government certainly does that as well, and it is under the Federal Credit Union Act and under the Oregon Credit Union Act, Oregon credit unions and federal credit unions located in Oregon would be permitted to do this under the rules that govern them. It's simply the law that governs the public officials who manage public money that precludes them from actually placing the funds. And that is correct.
Thank you, Senator. Other questions? Additional testimony. Mr. Goodwin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ralph Goodwin, CEO of Grant Baker Federal Credit Union. We're a full-service community chartered credit union headquartered in John Day. We serve Grant and Baker counties. I'm here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 499, a bill that will allow taxing districts in Oregon to deposit their funds in Oregon credit unions. We've been serving Grant County since 1957 and Baker County since 1996. Our assets are $34 million, and we have over $27 million in loans. We have over 4,000 members in Grant County, which has 3,200 households. Approximately 38% of our loans are commercial. Agricultural lending amounts for much of our commercial portfolio. We work closely with the Farm Service Agency and their loan guarantee program. We use the guarantee program more than any other financial institution in Oregon. We also have nearly 500 commercial checking accounts. Like all credit unions, we're not for profit and democratically controlled. We pay the same taxes that are required of other financial institutions other than corporate income taxes. Our profits are paid to our members in the form of dividends, and they in turn pay taxes on those earnings. For several years, we've been approached by local taxing districts in need of low-cost financial services. We're allowed to accept those deposits, but they're prohibited from depositing with us. Before you use a petition sign, by all but one of the taxing districts in Grant County, asking you to approve 499. Those who will oppose this bill will tell you that we shouldn't have these funds because we don't pay income taxes. Nearly all the tax money received by these entities comes from property taxes. We pay property taxes like everyone else. In fact, if you look at the enclosed chart, we pay more in property taxes in Grant County than any of the three banks. You'll see another handout. It shows that over 75% of all bank deposits in Oregon are in institutions managed and controlled out of state. It seemed to me that if a bank in Minnesota or Ohio can be approved for public funds, that a community credit union, John Day, should also have that right. We're regulated by the National Credit Union Administration, and our deposit insurance fund has the highest reserve ratio of any deposit insurance fund. To summarize, credit unions have the staff, the expertise, and security to assist local taxing districts with the management of their funds. We respectfully ask for your support.
Questions for the committee? Hearing and seeing none. In summary.
Mr. Chairman, in summary, I just wanted to finalize with a few points. You have my full testimony, Pam Levitt, again, with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. The purpose of the bill is to simply provide for an open marketplace where all the public agencies will secure the most advantageous financial agreements for their dollars. We believe allowing credit unions to accept public funds will provide for increased competition. These deposits would reside in locally owned cooperatives. Many of these dollars would be reinvested back into the community and invested back to the membership. And as stated earlier with Senator George, there are over 20 states that have allowed credit unions to accept public deposits. And I've given you an example of many of the western states, Arizona, California, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, Utah. In fact, California have the California state constitution was amended by the voters in 1984 to allow credit unions to hold public funds. In the state of Indiana, which approved this in 1985, public entities are required to seek bids on their deposits. Oregon's credit unions are safe and sound, serving the citizens of the state very well. This bill does not require the public entities to deposit into credit unions, but gives them an open marketplace to make the best decision. I do want to say that we are pleased to have the support of the Oregon People's Utility District Association, the Oregon PUDs, and the Special District Association of Oregon. I've also met with the state treasurer, and he is supportive of this bill, and we agreed to continue discussions on the issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Questions for the panel from the committee? Hearing seen none.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I'm going to submit some letters of support I received from some PUDs and utility districts into the record also.
Yes, if you just make those available to our committee staff, we'll
thank you.
Make sure that the committee receives them and that they're added to the public record. I'd like to call Mr. Tim Martinez and Mr. John DePasquale from Oregon Banking Association. Maybe another view here.
I'm going to have to support this one.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association, not the other OBA. With me today is John DePasquale from a U.S. bank who we flew down from Portland this morning, since that's such a distance from the nation or state's capital. We have not had the opportunity to appear before you, before any a committee of legislature on opposite sides of the credit union since 1997. And I think that's been a good thing. Frankly, there are not a lot of issues left between the banks and the credit unions that are in dispute. 95 to probably 99% of the time we agree, and we work very closely with the credit unions in trying to accomplish good things for Oregonians from financial institutions. This, however, is one where we don't, and we just frankly have a fundamental disagreement on their abilities to take public fund deposits. They indicated that 20 or more states do allow this. I guess the converse of that is close to 30 do not. So it's not something that's universal in the country. And it is, you know, I think the I can't remember the phrase that Ms. Leavitt used about the marketplace. Mr. Bronner, my predecessor for a long time, used the phrase level playing field, and I think we're both saying the same thing, frankly. We're certainly willing to concede the fact on public fund deposits if the playing field was level. But the fact of the matter, it is not today in Oregon, as it is in many states. Yes, they pay property taxes. Yes, they pay a lot of taxes, but they don't pay corporate taxes, corporate income taxes. And we believe, and we can certainly provide you with data to suggest that that allows them to offer higher rates of interest as well as lower rates on loans, because frankly we have to pay taxes on those monies. When it comes, Mr. DePasquale is in charge from U.S. Bank of the public funds in your part of the world, Santa Fe, Central Oregon, and Eastern Oregon, so he can address the issue specifically in your part of the state. And frankly, you know, I could probably go on for hours and bore you, but this is just a fundamental disagreement that we have with the Credit Union Association. We are continuing to meet with them to try to work out this and other issues, and intend to continue to do that. So with that, Mr. DePasquale doesn't have any formal remarks, but would be here to answer questions or about how the process works. And I don't know, I'll just end there.
Mr. Martinez, I think the testimony that you offered this morning about the cooperative way in which the financial institutions of Oregon have been working together is important. And it is noted that it's been since 1997 since there was an issue of real contention between
banking and credit unions, and I would encourage you to keep meeting with the folks from the credit unions on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and see if there are some differences that can't be worked out. Any questions for Mr. Martinez? Senator Corford?
Well, just a question for Mr. DePasquale. The U.S. Bank is a, I presume it's a multi-state.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Corcoran, yes, that is correct.
And your headquarters are?
Currently in Minneapolis.
Okay. Thanks.
Further questions from the committee? I really appreciate the fact that you've come down to be available for the committee hearing, Mr. DePasquale. The issue today is just to frame the question, to make the committee members aware that there is an issue. We will come back for a work session later on this bill. So we only have it scheduled today for a public hearing. Further questions? Any other person here present that wishes to offer testimony on Senate Bill 499? If not, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 499. Colleagues, we have one other bill scheduled this morning for a public hearing, and that is a bill that the chairman thinks is a critically important bill to the economic future of the state of Oregon, and I may be the only person in Oregon that thinks it's a critically important element for the economic future of the state of Oregon. So we'll not spend more than just a few seconds on Senate Bill 468, but I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 468 and ask if any other person here present also thinks this is a critically important bill to the future of the economy in the state of Oregon. Seeing and hearing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 468. Move then to work sessions.
Was that a substantial hearing?
That was. Actually, we've already had a substantial public hearing on that bill, and we presented it to the committee, so it has a life of its own now. I'd like to...
Just wanted to note for the record that I did hear some public testimony, so it was substantial.
It was, as a matter of fact. As a matter of fact, we established for the record that that bill is critically important to the economic future of the state of Oregon.
We heard a substantial sentence.
And I would be worried myself if I were you, Senator Corcoran, about receiving a substantial sentence.
Right. And I ask what time it is, they always say 5 to 10.
Yeah. 2 to 5 in your case. Good behavior. Let us move to Senate Bill. Well, colleagues, let's just talk about what we have on the work session agenda. Senate Bill 555 is a bill that affects very many people. We heard some very compelling testimony about that bill. The unfortunate part of that is to do what arguably is the right thing for citizens. It will cost us about $10 million. And so it's my intention to move the bill to Ways and Means where it will languish with others, which are excellent purposes, and which will be considered in their due course if and when the May revenue forecast implies that we can actually deal with some of those cost issues. So I have no desire to hold that bill up in this process, but rather allow it to move forward to get a fair hearing the way we need to
process. Move to purgatory.
Well, if we... I don't know. We can't move it to the floor without having the revenue folks work it anyway. So that would be the next step in the process.
Yeah, I know.
So let's not hold it up in our process here.
It's a fiscal issue.
It is a fiscal issue.
It is a fiscal issue, and I think it would be important for us also to examine the issue that... because folks that are maybe in the lower income levels may drop their insurance, that we may in fact be looking at increased cost to the state as they come on board our provisions for their care.
Okay, so it would be the chair's intention to open the work session, have that issue added to the public record in work session, entertain a motion to move to the fiscal consideration of Ways and Means. On Senate Bill 67, I think what we need here is recognition that we have an up or down situation. We've got a potential referral on the personal income, corporate income, and excise tax options. And I think what we do is move that to the floor and let that stand or fall based on the merits of the argument. Senate Bill 260, we have a new run to present to the committee. It's scheduled for a work session, although I don't think it's fair to ask the committee to consider moving the bill without having adequate consideration of the new run. There's some other information, too, on Senate Bill 259 that moved out of the Education Committee. So it'd be my intention just to open a public hearing on, or a work session, get the new information on the new run on the record, and let the members think that through. And then Tuesday, when we bring it back, it would be our intention to move that bill. So, colleagues, that's the chair's intention with the three bills in the work session. And let's begin with Senate Bill 555. Let me open a work session on Senate Bill 555. And is there anybody here who wishes to offer additional testimony on Senate Bill 555 briefly? Knowing the chair's intentions to move that bill forward, would you like to make your case here or in front of the Ways and Means? Thank you. There's a question, Senator Starr.
A comment.
Yes, sir.
I have recently been made aware that there's a growing interest in a medical program called Simple Care. And this has been initiated by a few doctors. And in Washington, they have already signed up doctors in Oregon. And the purpose of Simple Care is to provide care for all folks at a reasonable price. Those folks who sign up for Simple Care would, in most cases, have long-term care or catastrophic policies, but would deal directly with their local physician at a cost savings of 30% to 40%.
Wow.
And if they're unable to pay, they've worked out a program where these patients can work off their bill by providing either public service or by working in the clinic. I think it's a fine program. It's growing rapidly. Over 6,000 families now signed up, over 600 physicians involved in the program. It provides an answer for health care that we will never quite reach with public dollars. But this bill would have a tremendous stimulus for that program. And I believe that this needs an opportunity to progress.
We are in work session on Senate Bill 555.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
I would move Senate Bill 555 to Ways and Means.
Any questions about the motion? Any objections to the motion? Colleagues, the motion has been made to move Senate Bill 555 to Ways and Means without comment or objection. So ordered. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 555 and move that along with our best wishes for a fair consideration of Ways and Means for us. Let us open up the work session on Senate Bill 67. We are in work session on Senate Bill 67.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis.
If now is the appropriate time, I'd like to move the adoption of the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 67.
Let us have the presentation of the Dash 5 amendment for discussion purposes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 67 phase in the tax rate reduction for corporate capital gains. It starts with moving to a 7% maximum tax rate for capital gains beginning tax year 2003 and 2004, moves to a 6% rate for tax years 2005 and 2006, and then drops to the 4% rate for tax year 2007 and thereafter.
And Ed, there was a wide variety of timing options that were offered. Perhaps you could put Dash 5 in comparison for the record with the other amendments that were offered.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we passed out a sheet last time that displayed all of the options for this bill together on one page. And this is the the dash five amendments have the most gradual phasing effect. That is that the tax impact starts relatively low in the current biennium and then increases, but at a slow rate as the tax rate reductions are phased in. It does have, or does show some impact in the 2001-2003 biennium, and that is because it does have a an effective date of the tax year 2003. In comparison, the dash 3 amendment begin the phase in at a 6% rate, so the jump is greater in the beginning. But it does have a provision that the reduced rate, the 6% rate, is only allowed for capital gains realized after June 30th, 2003. And the intention of that provision was to eliminate a revenue impact in the 2001-2003 biennium. And I think it does that.
Chairman, whatever the committee's preference is, I assume it's probably better not to have a fiscal impact this biennium.
The discussion I've had with the proponents of the bill, Senator Muniz, have indicated their preference for the dash 3.
Right.
Because it removes the immediate revenue impact.
All right. I would so move if that's appropriate at this time.
Withdraw. So the senator wishes to withdraw his motion on the dash 5 and substitute the motion for the dash 3. Colleagues, the motion is for the amendments of the bill by the adoption of the dash 3 amendments. Is there discussion? Senator Porter?
Was there any discussion by the proponents of where they would take the money out in this hole that they create in the next general fund? Or any discussion about term limits for tax bills as well as for legislators?
Actually, Senator, I think there was some discussion about the growth of economy and recognition that some of the tax cut is mitigated by growth in the economy. But I think primarily it is an issue that is simply being offered for consideration in the same vein as other tax cuts are being considered nationally in the capital gains issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll be a big no on this one. It's basically a huge tax break for the wealthy. Top 1% of Oregonians with average incomes of $923,000 would receive 55% of the tax reduction. Bottom 80% with incomes less than $69,000 would get just 8%. The poorest 20% effectively would be excluded from the tax cut. This is a huge giveaway.
For the discussion on the amendment, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's some interesting issues that were presented and potential impacts, and there certainly was some need to discuss this, but I think given the fiscal climate we're in, frankly, the bottom line is that I just don't think we can afford this. When you look at the primary beneficiaries of this, it's high-income individuals and as some discussion, high-tech companies, which are the same ones, interestingly, that are in the building arguing strongly for increased investments in higher ed, which I also believe in, that we need to do. But I think the proper thing that we need to do is put this in perspective of the balance program. I know that Representative Shetterly and his committee have been working on that, and that envisioned part of this there. I just don't think I can support it standing alone, given the fiscal environment we're in, for many of the good reasons that are there. There's also some fiscal realities that I don't see a way to accomplish.
Other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo.
Thank you. My concerns about this are pretty much in line with Senator Byers. I think that in the presentation that we got and the report we got about our capital gains tax and taking a look at the overall, how it works and other issues related to it, there were some very good issues brought up before us that I had not, you know, thought about before in terms of that tax, which I think warrant further consideration by us. When I look at the revenue impact here, I guess for me the first questions that come to mind are, you know, so do we have too much, you know, do we have too many state police now? Do we have, enough support for higher education? Are our classroom sizes small enough to make sure that children, you know, don't have obstacles to learning. And I ask those kinds of questions to myself, and if I could say, oh, sure, we don't have to deal with those issues, and I think we could afford to do some of these tweaks to the capital gains tax. But I just don't see that we can afford to do this right now. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Benton.
Just a brief statement for my Democratic colleagues and friends here. The reason that I'm supporting this is kind of a bet on the come line, so to speak, in that, you know, I have some of the same concerns that have been mentioned about revenue impact, and I've spent a great deal of time with AOI and others, you know, arguing that point. But what I've concluded is that there are a lot of people who I work with in the police department and other people in public employment who are two, you know, married couples working together, who, when their combined incomes are put together, they're in that rich category, so to speak. There are people who the tax laws consider them wealthy. And when I have conversations with them about how they're treated under the tax laws, they are very concerned about how they're going to deal with retirement issues and rolling over their deferred compensation packages and so on and so forth when they retire. So it's not just a, you know, a wealthy versus not wealthy issue, but I am making some assumptions in voting for this, that providing this kind of benefit reduction tax to individuals who do have resources is going to eventually feed back into you know, the environment of entrepreneurialism in the state of Oregon. And I think we've heard a lot about our direction transition from a timber-based economy to a technology-based economy, information-based communities, and so on and so forth. And I'm betting on the come that that's going to happen. But I think Republicans and others who have that kind of viewpoint, generally, in terms of wanting the free enterprise system to function well, have to also be cognizant that at some point, if those theories do not work, and if it isn't functioning well, that we have to go to the questions that Senator Castillo raised about, are there sufficient resources to meet the needs and demands of the public? And I for one, would have to be a Republican who would stand up and have to vote in favor of some revenue increase in the event that that didn't happen. But because of my philosophical mind and my ideology, which I hold dearly, because I believe that people should have the opportunity to achieve in our culture and our society, I'm going to bet on the come that this is going to work, in addition to some other tax breaks. And the early one that I addressed, I was ready to vote for. Unfortunately, it was a public hearing only. But I'm also prepared to vote differently, in the event that it isn't working, because I do think we have to go into this eyes wide open and be honest about it.
Senator Byers.
I think there's some honest feelings on the table there, and I'm just struck. I was struck this morning. I was in a meeting with a group called the Southern Willamette Research Quarter, which is sort of the Southern Valley's equivalent to the, I think it's the New Economy Coalition in the North. Mm-hmm. And listening to Senator Durfler express the comment to them that he thought that their concerns about investments in higher education were right on target and were valid, that we need to do that, but there wasn't enough money, and business is going to have to step up to the plate and pay for more of those things at a higher level if they want them. That's a dilemma we face there.
Well, I was at a high-tech higher ed conference up in Portland. I think it was right before the session. And during a break, was talking to the Senate president, and he told this funny story about being out on the campaign trail. And he's kind of uncharacteristic of the Senate president. He was making funny. And he said... He said, you know, it's very interesting being out on the campaign trail, and you're talking to, the high-tech folks, and if you're in a position like I am, you can say, so what can I do for you? And he said, when I talk to the high-tech folks, they would say, what you need to do for us is you need to provide more engineering education. You need to provide more sort of infrastructure for high-tech to succeed in this state. And by the way, we'd like a capital gains cut, too. And the Senate president says, you know, it's interesting, you know, maybe we should have the beneficiaries of the engineering pay for the engineering, and then we wouldn't have to worry about the tax cuts.
Good point.
It just proves, Mr. Chair, that old lineage about the best tax is the one someone else pays.
Well, the committee's been very forthcoming about it. I'll go to Senator George, and then I'll have a comment. Well, Mr. Chairman, I just happened to be looking back at my little Senate Bill 555 and its little impact, which would have, of course, helped folks with premiums, been able to deduct them long-term care. And this is 50 times the impact of my little bill that went to purgatory. So I just hope we're aware of that. I'm going to support this, but I just sure think we need to try to get some balance here on some of these things.
Senator George, I think your argument's good and it's compelling. And I will help you if you wish to make it at Ways and Means. The chairman has another issue, and I brought it up during the public hearing on this bill. Like many parents, I started saving for my college, my children's college education when they were born, you know, literally, instead of gifts that would end up probably being recycled in the Goodwill basket in a relatively short period of time. We asked people to put money into stocks or savings certificates or savings bonds against their future education. And when you start saving for a child's education when they're born, by the time they're 17 or 18 years old, you know, if you've invested reasonably, you probably have enough to put them through 2 or 3 years at least in college, maybe all 4. But if you've invested in the stock market, you were pretty happy 2 years ago, but you were pretty unhappy about 6 months ago. And a lot of folks were trapped in that roller coaster ride because even to move from a stock position to a cash position, you create a taxable event. And the capital gains tax is the one that you pay. And even though these dollars are taxed at the relatively lower rate of the child, the taxable event can be enough to keep people from making the decision to move from stocks into cash if they think the market's going to bubble. Capital gains affects people in a lot of different ways. And one of them is to eliminate flexibility and fluidity in the way people manage funds for themselves or for their other beneficiaries. So I think that anything we can do to ease the burden of capital gains serves a whole panoply of citizens in the state of Oregon, and that's why I would support the bill. But we're in work session. We've had the Dash 3 amendments moved. Let's go ahead and call the roll since we have some objectors.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. And by my math, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
I hear a chorus from the objectors.
Go ahead.
Just served notice in order report.
Yes, we expected. Thank
and
you.
Chair, I just wanted to make a comment about the vote. You know, if you take a look at this, the greatest tax relief to Oregon's, it gives the greatest tax relief to Oregon's least needy taxpayers. It widens the gap between the haves and have-nots. And yet, in this committee, we have spent so much time looking at those parts of our state where people are struggling. You know, we have very low-income families in rural parts of our state, very needy programs in the rural parts of our state. Small schools have been a huge issue in this committee, trying to help small schools because of what's happening with that economy. So here we are passing a bill that does nothing for the most needy in our state and takes money out of our revenue stream. And, you know, it's just like, I'm thinking about the discussions we've had in this committee. I don't see how they just don't make sense to me when we have, you know, if you put the whole picture of what we've been discussing and focusing on in this committee, and it's just, I just have to say that for the record.
Senator Castillo, I'm particularly sensitive to your commentary. The only thing that I can offer in answer to it, and really it is not argumentation, it's just another perspective. Anything that we can do to grow the economy in those communities and anything that we can do to incent investment will help more than just redistribution of the existing revenue, which is one of the things that we've been mired in. But rather than add to the record in that way, let's go ahead and take the next step on Senate Bill 67. We have the amendments approved and the notice of service of potential minority report, I think, attaches to the main bill, but let's do that in a second. Senator Minnis.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 67 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a two-pass recommendation.
It is moved that we take Senate Bill 67 as amended to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. The clerk will, oh, discussion? If you start with that.
Chairman, I just to my motion, in 1993, when we were moving from a property tax-based system to fund education to a general fund-based system, which is what we have now, for better or for worse, we were able to do that only because our economy is growing exponentially. And it was only because people did invest in job creation and business creation and so on and so forth. So, you know, I think ultimately, you know, if this works, it'll be a moot point. And again, I want to reiterate, if it doesn't work, I'm going to be right there with some of my colleagues saying, we've got to fix this thing. We've got to do something about it. So, again, we're betting on the come line, but I'm willing to make the bet.
Thanks, Senator Minnis. Notices, for those that have ears to listen, I think you've given a pretty clear notification. Senator George?
Mr. Chairman, dittos to that last comment. And the other thing being is that I think we need to keep in perspective our all funds revenue budget is $4.77 billion. This is 1/8 of that amount. And so I think just we need to just keep everything in perspective. And I made the point to my little bill and its impact on folks that might need long herb toe. But on the other side, looking at the impact that this could, that this is relationship to total growth, but also on the backside of whenever you give a break like this, you normally get economic development, which right now we certainly do need. Yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
On the other hand,
on the other hand.
If this money is subtracted from those parts of this of the general fund that are used to get matching funds from the feds, then you're talking about a much greater loss to the system. So,
you know, I think that's one of the things that we can at least say about our committee is that we aired our feelings and considered our issues heartfelt and expressed our opinions. Let's call the roll.
No.
No.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye. Motion passes. Farioli will carry, and I understand there would be, before the gavel falls.
Serve notice of minority report.
Senator Corcoran, for the record.
Serve notice of minority report, Mr. Chair.
Notice is hereby received by the chair that there will be possibly a minority report filed on the bill. This is the work session on Senate Bill 67. As amended, goes to the floor. Chair carries. Last item of business, we have, what do we have left? Senate Bill 468, and that is, no, we did that one. That's not on our work session. Oh.
It's on your mind.
colleagues, we have before us Senate Bill 260. And let us open the work session for the purpose of having an update from Steve. And we have another run on the PSD issues. This run is, reflects recommendations, but I'll let Steve give the orientation of the committee.
I know.
Colleagues, destroy all previous copies of all runs that have been distributed.
Mr. Chair, members, for ESDs, that hasn't really happened. Okay, Senate Bill 260 deals with ESD revenue. What I have done here for Simulation 2 for ESDs is to go back to the legislation from 1999 that set up a fixed amount per weighted student for ESDs that were below the average. And so for those that were below the average, it brought them up different amounts to this statutory dollar amount per weighted student. In working with that, I pretty much took the extra dollars that are expected to be available to ESDs, both from property taxes and the state school fund, and said if you chose to hold those ESDs that are above the state average harmless on a dollar amount per weighted student from the prior year, and then you took the
new funds that were available and directed those to the school districts that were below the state average in terms of dollars per ADMW, what might that result be? And to do that, I took those dollar amounts in the statute and said, I'll increase them a certain amount, and I'll increase the lower dollar amounts a higher percentage than those that are closer to the mean. I took the $125 for Deschutes, for example, and increased that to $160 for about a 28% increase. For those that were at $150 statutory amount, last session I increased that to $175 for a 17% increase, and so on. So that was the general approach to arrive at the table that you have for 01-02, raising the statewide average from about $241 to $252. But you'll also see, if you look under the revenue difference column for 01-02, that there are a few negatives there in total dollars. That's because of a decline in weighted students in those ESDs, but at the same dollar level per weighted student. Right, and then the last column, or the right-hand column, shows you several zeros for those that don't gain on a per weighted student basis, and then the increase for those that are below the average in terms of what they would be. So the chute shows a $37 increase per weighted student. That's the highest, and then it tapers off from there to a zero. One thing I did not do here that I probably should have, Clackamas ESD is just slightly under the average. I intended to bring them up to the average, but I didn't get that done, so you'll see that they're still at 237, which is still below the 241 average for 2000-2001. So this only deals with the first year. There would be additional revenue to ESDs in the second year. I didn't get that far, kind of waiting for a reaction to this approach.
Okay, and I think we could, let's begin with the discussions that we had with Senate Bill 216. When we last visited this issue, one of the things that we heard from some of the larger ESDs was that they would love to be held harmless, that is to say, no decrease in the funding formula for ESDs, because they wanted to at least not have a prospect of equalization come out of their funding. Then we looked at the five least funded, smallest ESDs, and clearly the committee, I think, heard testimony that they were below what they would consider a viable amount to be able to deliver services. And the issue that was driving this question was the potential lawsuit for equalization of funding through ESDs. And one approach that was offered was that we freeze fund those ESDs at the higher levels, use the savings from, or at least the increase in funding for ESDs to bring the lowest five up to a level that they thought could sustain critical mass. And that seemed to be an issue that, or at least seemed to be an approach that didn't engender a lot of opposition. And I don't know if anybody was wildly favorable to the idea of flat funding, but I thought it was particularly generous from the folks from the larger ESDs to say, just leave us alone and we'll be fine. We heard some of the same thing from the North Central ESD, who basically said, you know, for gosh sakes, we fought hard to get where we are, leave us alone. That didn't help the other four of the smallest ESDs that really need to be brought up in equalization. The question also before the committee was, what step are we going to take toward equalization to be able to show the courts that, in fact, we're on the same track that we went down with school funding equalization, and that is to move forward on this issue before we've been ordered to do so by the courts, or before actually it's been a mandated issue. So that was one approach. This is another approach. This is another distribution type approach. So on Tuesday, colleagues, and I urge you to talk to each other and talk to your ESDs. The chair will bring forth a proposal that reflects flat funding or freeze funding the top ESDs and moving the bottom five ESDs up, and then a distribution formula that equalizes as much as possible or takes some steps toward equalization. We'll also consider implications from the approach that Steve's brought forward. It is another approach to accomplish a step toward equalization, although it does change the numbers somewhat in the top category and in the bottom category, but it makes a different distribution to some of those smaller ESDs that are scattered across the state. I guess the point here is that there's some other considerations that were contained in the report that Mr. Campbell and others brought to the committee. We should consider all those things one more time. But I guess we're devoting the entire work session on Tuesday to Senate Bill 260, and this is where we'll begin. Any questions, Senator Beyer?
Just one quick one, couple of things. But one, does this assume that the equalization transfers that were still sort of remnants in the and I don't remember which two
grant will allow us
to be eliminated?
Yeah, I think the Steve's approach perpetuates that, but at some point in time we really need to look at that for elimination.
Is there a reason why we want? It just seemed to me like that was just an anachronism from the past. Is there a reason we wouldn't want to just pull that out?
It would take away those funds from being counted on the PTEL side.
I understand that.
And
we increase the amount of money that would go to those school districts.
From other school districts. It would basically shift that money to ESDs.
Well, put it this way. I think we ought to look at that formula, understand the effect fully, make the decision whether or not we want to perpetuate that, because that's what people are used to. That's what they plan for.
Well, could I ask Steve one more time, see if I understand this. What you're doing is freezing the funding for any ESD so it didn't drop below its prior year's funding on a ADMW basis?
Correct.
And then it starts a redistribution. Those that were below the statewide average would move up after an equal whatever the amount was proportionally. Is that what it does effectively?
Yes. It gives a higher percentage increase to the lowest. And the closer you get to the average, the lower that percentage increase becomes.
Where do I see those percentages?
You
that formula. How did you do that?
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Okay.
And the colleagues will. Steve mentioned that he didn't have adequate time to array all of the math, so. We'll make sure that all the committee members understand the methodology behind the method that Steve brought forth today. Colleagues, do you have any other questions about Senate Bill 260? And all I ask you to do is go through your notes, review the testimony in your mind, and be prepared to look at in-depth 260 from 8 a.m. till 10 a.m. on Tuesday. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, one issue that I keep bringing up, and I think a few others are doing it, and that's the idea that probably the only way you'll ever be able to do this is to have the special ed children dollars actually follow them out. Senator Minister's talked about a couple ideas like that. Could we get a report, too, on the disposition of those bills, where they are? I think most of them have.
Sure. The other thing, Senator George, just to add to your comment, is that we've been asked to consider equalization on a service basis rather than just on a pure ADMW basis. And part of 260 is a request for the Campbell's Committee, the ESD Study Committee, to go back and look at service delivery based on services provided by both the school district and the ESD, and look at equity from the definition of service delivery. I'll add another permutation to our consideration. Senator Minnis and I have been discussing his intent to bring forward, possibly bring forward, a consideration of a more market-driven system for ESD services. And that's something that I think we need to listen to carefully, make sure that we've either framed that as a question that we asked in the context of Campbell's or whoever takes this thing through the interim process, or make a requirement of school districts and ESDs to show us how it is that they can justify to the legislature that the current configuration of their service delivery systems is the best value and the best equity and the most responsive to the needs of school
patrons, parents, and students. That, I think, is the issue about whether or not we have equity on a service system, or just are we cranking an ADMW model and using it in an ESD format. I hope I captured some of that.
Mr. Chairman, I think at this point, what I'll offer is some transition to a system similar to what the state of Washington has, where they serve twice as many students with 9 ESDs, and it's a more market-driven system. If I can get that language codified in some amendment, I'll at least offer that.
Okay. Thanks, Senator. Other questions? Any other business to come before the committee? We'll close the work session on 2:60, and we are in adjournment until Monday.